this first.
There we go. That's about it. That's very kind. Good morning. So, this morning we're going to be talking about the 12 links of dependent origination. I can't remember, is there a tanka of the 12 links in here? The wheel of life? We don't have one of them. You have? Okay. Today will be first session, and then next week we'll have a second session. So, sort of like, this is 12 links 101. Next time, 12 links 102. So, as we're waiting, because some people, by necessity, are coming in piecemeal, we're going to begin with a little meditation and motivation, as we've been doing in most of the courses. So, sit comfortably, with your spine erect, your body erect, and relax your body, which is relatively simple, sometimes not as simple. Let go of the tension in your body. Relax your mind, which is much more difficult. Remind yourself anything that you're thinking about can be thought about later. There's nothing that has to be done right now except for the meditation to tame our mind. So just as if you were listening to a sound, you don't have to create a sound to hear it. In the same way, just observe your breathing in, changing direction, out, changing direction, inhalation, and that little point, inflection point, when it changes to an exhalation. Just be aware of that, letting everything else fade into the background, all your thoughts, all your observations of the senses. Just observe the breathing with the awareness of when you're breathing in, when you're breathing out, especially the endpoints, when it's changing from one direction to another. like most people today, you may be adept at multitasking. So your mind may be partially watching the breathing and partially thinking about your plans for lunch or later today or worrying about something in the past, whatever. Give up those thoughts. Invest that mental energy into this enterprise of watching the breathing, just observing it. Once you've gotten a clear idea of the breathing as an object of observation, try to establish the faculties of mindfulness and alertness. Mindfulness is like the magnet or mental glue that keeps you on the object that you have just observed, something you've already understood, such as the breathing. And alertness or introspection is a mental factor, faculty of the consciousness that is a little part of the mind is invested in watching whether you're wandering onto other thoughts, whether you've lost the breathing. See if you can discern the exact moment when the breathing changes from one direction to another. If you watch carefully, it might seem that that point is a little bit blurred, as though there are two processes going on, the physical breathing and something that precedes it, some energy current within the body that's linked up with that. As the breathing gets more regular and calm, shallow, you have to use more attention. So this is helping your concentration. You have to, as though, dive into that experience, into a deeper state of concentration to watch the breathing. if your mind wanders off from the object, starting to think about other things, notice it with alertness. Bring it back to the breathing, which you've already recognized. Hold it there with the magnet or glue of mindfulness. When your mind is a little bit calmed, your breathing is more regular, follow a breath up your nostrils as though it's going to the crown of your head, to your throat, to your heart chakra. Leave your attention there in the middle of your chest, a little bit middle in terms of left and right, but a little toward the back. And just watch your mental consciousness now. Let go of your attention to the breathing. Watch the contents of your mind, what you're thinking about. Of calm, clarity, just focus on that. Try to get an idea of that clarity, which is the nature of the mind. Like empty space, unobstructing, allowing thoughts to come, emerge from it, and dissolve back into the consciousness. When the thoughts are present, try to recognize that their very nature is consciousness, in the same way that the waves on the surface of the ocean or a lake or the reservoir. The waves are still the nature of water. And letting go with following the thoughts, let them dissolve back into the spaciousness of the mind. This is the waves fall back into the body of water of the lake or ocean. Here we're trying to identify something much more subtle than the breathing. So you may feel frustrated at first, trying to find this clarity, clear light nature of the mind, one of its defining characteristics. Mind is like a large body of clear water within which different fish-like thoughts swimming around. Unlike the aquarium, when you don't focus on the fish-like thoughts in your mind, they'll actually disappear. You're not feeding them with attention. The seeming irrefutable presence of your body, perhaps your sight or the tactile sense, all are appearing to your mental consciousness as thoughts. Let go of that perception of them and try to instead focus on the consciousness that is perceiving those images, the nature of that consciousness. Turn your attention away from the thought, the objective thoughts, to the subjective mind. This is the subjective experience of those thoughts, clear and knowing. You need to do it again and again. Let go of your perception of the body. It becomes a little mantra in your mind. Let go. Whenever something seems to solidify, let go and try to perceive the consciousness that is experiencing that thought or image. And again, once you've begun to find a little glimpse of this clarity, institute these faculties of mindfulness and alertness. Hold on to that clarity. Be mindful of it. And part of your mental energy in the form of an alertness that recognizes whether you've wandered off or whether you're losing the strength of that mindfulness. Although you may not be perceiving the nature of the mind barely, directly, still it's an experiential one. It's something that's changing moment by moment, as the mind is impermanent also. Even let go of your sense of an observer, yourself being the observer of the mind. That too is an image to your consciousness. Just dive into the mind itself, as though there's no difference between you and the mind. Clear, knowing, having a nature like a clean mirror. Whatever is presented to the mind takes that aspect, just as a reflection in a mirror takes the aspect of what is placed, whatever is placed before the mirror. This is a very profound observation, this nature of the mind. And we're, from a Buddhist perspective, we're very fortunate just now, as a human, now to recognize it, to recognize that we have the potential within our mind to eliminate all the negative states of mind that disturb us at one time or another, anger, jealousy, pride, low self-esteem, depression. We don't need them. We don't have to follow them. In fact, they're not part of our minds, so we don't have to follow them. We can go back to this clear light nature, clear our mind, and instead of these destructive thoughts, even attachment, you know, clinging, let go of them, and in their place build up the positive states of mind, compassion, empathy, self-confidence. Love, starting from ourself, loving ourself, recognizing that we deserve to be happy just as much as anyone else, and extending that to others. This is a situation that we have right at the moment to recognize this, to feel some joy in this. But it's impermanent, it's changing. This life will eventually come to an end. So we should be energized to take advantage of this right now, right this instant. Thinking, during this next period of time while the talk is going on, I'm going to pay attention, listen for those essential points that can help me heal myself in this fundamental way, to heal my mind, overcome my unruly states of mind. And I'm going to do so not just for my own welfare, not just to heal myself in a very profound way, but to become less a burden for others, less harmful to others. And once we reach that state, to actually develop the capacity to benefit them, benefit other beings, to be a source of joy and happiness, of intelligence and wisdom that can guide them. I think that's for that reason I'm going to be listening to the teachings, in order to live up to my highest potential, to achieve what we call enlightenment. With the aim to be able to benefit sentient beings from that state. To make a positive contribution to the world rather than only worrying about ourselves or only making a short-term contribution in terms of, you know, making money, raising a family. I think I'm going to participate in the class this morning to achieve enlightenment, my highest potential, for the sake of all living beings. And then slowly relax. Relax your body, relax your mind. Oh, hey. Wow, are we lucky? Okay, this is exceptional. Excepcionale. So what you're receiving is a representation of what is called the wheel of life, or the wheel of existence, Sipe Corno. A mural like this is often painted in the entryways of temples, Buddhist temples. When I was at monastery in Wisconsin for many years, I used to lead tours of the different school kids or college students that would come, and this would be one place that was a big mural, maybe like half the size of the wall there, this almost identical to this, and explained it to the kids. So we'll come back to this in a second. You can keep it right there. We'll explain about this. But basically, the topic of this lecture today and the next one is the outer rim, the pictures in the outer rim, what are called the 12 branches or 12 links of dependent origination. So the whole mural generally is referred to as Sipe Corno, Bhava Chakra, the wheel of existence, or the wheel of becoming. That's the whole drawing with this big being in the center. It's jaws. You have one, right? Who's that person in the center? Is that, yeah? No. Around. So. His feet are on the bottom. The face is on the top. Who is this? Yamantaka? Who knows? You know. Who is it? Mahakala? The great black one? No, she says no. Yama. Maybe Yama. Yeah, not Yamantaka. Yama is an Indian word that means... that refers to the Lord of Death. I don't know in Indian culture, I mean in Chinese culture, if you have some personification of death, what do you call it in Chinese? Was it? Yang Ho Wang? I thought I did a good job. Don't laugh. So you know what she said, right? In America, there's something like there's some representation like these skeletons, like a skeleton with the thing that you cut the Grim Reaper, which you cut the grain with, you know, when in the harvest, what is it called, the scythe. So it's as though this Grim Reaper is going to come and eventually cut you down, right? It's a little bit like the same sense of yama. Yama, from a Buddhist perspective, maybe there is an actual sentient being who, like there is a sentient being called Brahma and Indra and so forth. Maybe there actually is a sentient being called yama because of their karma for some period of time. At any rate, yama represents the inevitability of death. When we talked about in one of our earlier courses, some of you were there, some of you were not, we talked about meditation on death. And one of the meditations was to recognize the inevitability of death. And the way it was phrased in the Tibetan text is, the Lord of Death, Yama, comes to everyone, and there's no way to escape him. Some of you remember, right? So this is the same. You can call Yama the Lord of Death, or the Grim Reaper, or whatever you like. Or, what was it? Okay, Cece? Yeah. Yen. Oh, wah. Okay. I'll pretend I'm saying it. So, why is Yama around here? Because all of this wheel of existence, the Sibi Korlo, is under the influence of destruction, eventual destruction. What we call gross impermanence. And also subtle impermanence. Everything is changing moment by moment. So that's an important element to keep in mind. Around the edge, the outer rim, there are 12 little circles. Okay? And these represent the topic matter, the 12 links of dependent origination. So we'll start at, what is that, like 12:30. Just at the top, a little to the right. Do you see? What does that look like to you? That first drawing? You see? Yeah, you know already. Because you're saying, can you tell it's a blind person? Well, maybe you can, because it's sort of like a blind person with a cane, and one hand is out. See? So this represents the first of the 12 links, which is ignorance, which is generally, ignorance is the inability to see reality. But in a more profound way, ignorance is a misseeing, you know, seeing something incorrectly, almost like with cataracts or with... There's something that when you get a little bit older, some of us who are a little bit older maybe notice there's certain little things within the fluid in your eye that are floating around. What do they call them? Floaters. It's not strangely enough. There's probably some medical term for it. That you, when you're looking, it's almost as though some little snake or hair is falling down. Some of you who are young. Oh, there's only one or two young ones. You don't notice floaters yet, right? Do you notice in your eye? So anyway, they kind of obscure things, and you might actually think there's hair falling into your tea or into your food or something. So that first link represents the mental ignorance, not something with our eyes. Next one, what is that? Can you tell? What's that person doing? Looks like he's making a pot. Although sometimes it's represented, there's a wheel. You know how potters have a spinning wheel that they make on? Sometimes that's below it. This one looks like there's just a square board below, but the wheel makes more sense in this regard. This one represents a second link called formation of karma. Do you know the word karma? What does karma mean? Action. Yeah, good. It's an Indian word that means action, right? I think I mentioned in one of the other lectures when I had asked the high school kids when they came, they all had this idea that they knew what karma meant. They said, what goes around comes around. Have you heard that expression? I did some research, I mentioned before, that phrase seems to have originated during the Dark Ages in Europe, when the plague, the Black Death, would go from village to village, and someone would ask, "Is the Black Death coming here?" And the expression was, "What goes around comes around." It's not so much talking about karma. I think a much better sort of little phrase to explain what karma is what Jesus was supposed to have said in the Testament. Ye reap what ye sow. Or if you plant, you know, good seeds, you're going to get good results. If you plant bad seeds, you're going to get bad results. You can't get a good crop from planting poisonous seeds. If you plant wholesome medicinal seeds, you're not going to get a bad poisonous crop from it. So this potter is representing that due to the condition of ignorance in our mind, we're impelled to create actions through our body, our speech, but predominantly through our mind. And our mind is the main creator, the main potter that creates karma. It motivates our body and speech. And we accumulate, sometimes in other representations, if there's a wheel the potter is making, and in the background you see the storeroom with many, many pots that have been, what we say, thrown or made, are stored. So like that, when we create actions, we leave an imprint in our consciousness, like the storing of those pots. And that's that consciousness upon which we first deposit, and you know, the imprint of the action is represented by the next link there. What is that? Is that an orangutan? What is that? It's a monkey. It's supposed to be a monkey that is in a tree. Like our monkey mind. So the third link is called consciousness. So it's going to have significance at this point as the recipient of the seeds of karma that are planted in our consciousness. And later it will be important, because at a later point, those seeds that are stored in our consciousness, once they're activated, we'll consider that consciousness again when the seed becomes ready to give its result, the karmic result, say, for instance, rebirth or whatever. And the next one, there's a boat, obviously, Tibetan. This looks like a Tibetan, one of those skin, yak skin boats. Have you ever been? They cross there are a lot of big rivers in Tibet. I remember when I visited Tibet, when going to Samye, this one famous monastery, we had to cross one of the big rivers. What was it? Is it the Brahmaputra close to the Samye? Can't remember. Has anyone been to Tibet? Anyway, there was a big coracle like this. Big one across. So this one represents what's called name with or without form. Or sometimes they just say name and form. Name and form. Literally in the Tibetan and Sanskrit, it's name with or without form. As I'll explain why that is. So what this represents is when we take a body, if we have an existence, a human existence or an animal existence, any kind of living being, we have mental faculties, at least, which are here represented by the word name. Why is that? Because a person is designated by a name. Right? Sweet Kim or KK or Joy or, you know, George, Wee Chin, we have a name. The minimal the minimal stuff that you need to give a name of a human is consciousness, the mental consciousness, the senses, and so forth, or at least the mental consciousness. So the mental faculties, when we talk about the five aggregates, have you heard that expression, the five skandhas? So the Buddha explained this term, the Indian word skanda, which means heap or aggregate. He said that if you take a human being apart, or an animal apart, you can put all of the physical things in one pile. That's mainly what we see. But if you consider the mental parts, there are four more parts. The one part is called the form aggregate, and then there's the feeling aggregate, which is part of our mind, which you don't see, right? But you can imagine putting all the feelings in one pile, one skanda or heap. And discrimination, the ability to discriminate, another pile. All of the mental factors, like love and hate and attachment and anger and so forth, in another pile, we call compositional factors. And then the last pile, which just the bare mental, bare consciousness itself, what we call, main mind, or as opposed to mental factors. So, if an ordinary human, we have all five of those aggregates. So we have form and these four mental parts, which are called name, because they're the basic, the bare minimum that you need to give a name. In the formless realm, there's a realm that we can take birth in, and we can actually meditate and achieve mentally that state called the formless realm. There is no gross form as we have now. There might be some very, very subtle form that's almost imperceptible, but it's as though all that exists, the person that is born in that realm, doesn't have a gross body like we have. So they don't have form. They just have mind, or in other words, the word that's being given here, name. So this one is called name with or without form. Or you could sometimes, if you don't want to take that, if that sounds a little bit awkward, you just say name and form. So what that represents is, as a result of having left some imprints on our consciousness, this monkey, eventually we will take rebirth. And at first, the first entry into, let's say as a human, you enter into a fertilized egg in mother's womb. Is that always the case? Maybe in the petri dish nowadays? Artificial, have you heard? They put ovum in a petri dish with some fluids, and then they put the sperm in there, and that. So maybe there's some people, obviously, that have been conceived that way. The mind from the intermediate state enters into that fertilized egg, not necessarily in mother's womb, but in the petri dish later, put in mommy's, put in a surrogate mother's womb. Have there been any babies grown outside the womb? Maybe in China. No, I shouldn't say. Maybe in America, maybe in Russia or someplace, they're experimenting. But right now, generally, so this represents that first, the first instance when you're taking the form. The form is the fertilized egg, so the egg, the ovum and the sperm, and the name is the subtle consciousness that's coming from a previous lifetime, entering into that form. If that consciousness from the previous lifetime takes rebirth in the formless realm, it doesn't have form. It just has that consciousness in the formless realm. So that's why it's called name with or without form. And the next one, what does that look like? Looks like a nice mansion. Anything particular about it? Well, you can't tell. but it's supposed to represent an empty house. So what this represents, and how many windows are there? 6 windows, right? So this is supposed to represent, once we've taken rebirth with name and form, there is a generation slowly of our 6 faculties, faculty of sight, hearing, smelling, tasting, touch, and the mental faculty, the ability to think. But at first, only one of those faculties is activated. Do you know which one comes first? Sight? Smell? And the mental faculty. Before the eye is formed, before the eye organ is formed, you can't see. Before the ear organ is formed, you can't hear, you can't smell without the nose organ and so forth. But the mental consciousness is there, and its organ is not the brain, as we might think. The organ of the mental consciousness is a previous moment of mental consciousness. So that's there from the beginning. So this house, which is supposed to be empty, maybe it has one resident, the mental consciousness. The other 5 faculties, other 5 windows, so to speak, are not, you can't see out of them yet because the organs are not yet, are just being formed, but there hasn't been yet contact with their respective objects. So what's the object of eye organ? Things you see, right? Shape and color. What's the object of ear consciousness? Sounds. Smells, tastes, objects of touch, which you have to think about. You don't understand what objects of touch. There's smooth and rough, and hot and cold are also objects of touch. You can experience, oh, that's hot, that's cold. So until there are, the consciousness, this house represents what are called the 6 faculties. So the as yet, they haven't made contact with their respective objects. Then the next one, what is that? You can say, it's a Buddhist class, but you can say, what's happening there? There's this couple engaged in some kind of sexual intercourse or something, right? This is represents the link called contact. What you might say, I contacted with my wife this evening. Okay. So contact represents this. Now that the faculties, maybe the nose faculty has been in the embryo, in the womb, has been created. The nose consciousness comes to that organ, and now in the womb, there may be some odors that the baby can smell. It's said in those beings that have clairvoyance, who can know the mind of an embryo, of a baby in the womb, say that there are very vile smells, so the baby does not find that pleasant, that when the nose organ. So this is contact with the particular objects. So it's just use the gross object. Usually sexual contact involves probably maybe your companion has some nice scent on, perfume, or nice, looks attractive and so forth. But the main thing is the tactile consciousness, right? In sexual intercourse, main thing is that. So this is that's representing all of the contacts with the respective objects. So what did we have? Ignorance, the formation of karma, consciousness, name, with or without form, the 6 faculties, and now contact. So it's at this point, within the womb, let's say, if we're talking about at birth as a human, that the various consciousness, sense consciousness and mental consciousness start to function Then what's the next one? What is it? What does it look like to you? What is it? Louder. Can you say louder? Did you say what it was? No, okay, I thought you said... What? Martial arts. Ah. Kung Fu or something, huh? Looks like... No. Yeah, that's a good guess, though. Yeah, I like that. Looks like he's doing some Kung Fu or Qigong or something. Yeah. No, this is actually supposed to be, and it doesn't look so clear to me. It's supposed to be a person with an arrow in their eye. Now, what is that experience going to be? Is that a pleasant experience? It represents the next link called feeling. So once the consciousnesses have contact with their objects, the main way that we experience the contact with objects is by the arisal of feeling or sensation in our consciousness. Basically, there are three kinds of feelings. Those that are pleasant, those that are unpleasant. You know, so what we say, if you talk about mental consciousness, you say happiness, and unhappiness, and then those feelings which are you can't categorize as, well, that's not particular. Like, if I ask you right now, how does your right earlobe feel? You say, well, no, if you concentrate, you can kind of, you know, I can kind of sense what's, it's not particularly pleasant, not particularly unpleasant, it's this kind of neutral, right? So three kind of feelings: pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, or happy, unhappy, and neutral. So this person supposed that he's holding an arrow, trying to pull the arrow out of his eye, I guess. Or I don't think he's trying to put it in his eye. So that represents feeling, which is the main way that our karma ripens on us, you know, during our life in terms of our own experience. Then the next one, what's that? That might, Tibetans know what that is, but you know, what's he holding in his hand, or was it? Durian? What? Water, drinking water. You're too optimistic. He's drinking beer. I said the Tibetans would know. So there's a big jug of, the Tibetans call it chang, you know, fermented. What is it made from? Barley, usually. Sometimes they make, like Chinese also make, that, or the Japanese make rice wine and things, some kind of inebriating drink. So this one, although water would work for the name of this, this one is usually, in English, often we translate it as craving, but the actual word is thirst. We talked, when the Theravada monk here was, that they assume, what was his name, Sumita, he mentioned that this is called tanha. In Sanskrit, it's called trisna. Tibetans translate it as sepa, and we translate that into English as craving. But really, the original word means thirst. Thirsting for the continuation of the feeling, or thirsting to be free of something that's unpleasant. You know, like the example that I gave, I think I'd seen some teaching, some explanation by Alex Berzin, where he gave the example of a rat drowning in the water, you know, grasping out for things. Well, this even comes, that's more the next length, the grasping, but this is thirst. The person, you know, when you taste a little something that's pleasant, you know, you taste a little, that's not bad. You want a little bit more, right? If it's something unpleasant, you want to be, you have a thirst or a craving to be free of that. So it goes both ways. It's not just craving to have something pleasant. Sometimes just craving to keep existing, not necessarily to keep feeling something good or to be free of unpleasant feeling, but even grasping at that neutral feeling just for existence, the craving. So that's the fellow. I think that's the fellow. Wouldn't you agree? It's not a lady. Then the next one, again, we've got a monkey here. And what is that monkey doing? Can you tell? You've got your mask on, so I can't hear you. Grasping. Right. He's tasted one mango, and now he's going for more. We collect. So this is an intensification of that thirst. This is what's generally called grasping. It's having tasted something, having a thirst for something, now intensifying that, so you're really grasping out, like the example I was giving a minute ago, in the wrong place, of the rat, the mouse or rat, drowning in water and grasping out at anything to keep alive, you know, even if it's a floating piece of garbage, you know. So what are these representing? Once we experience feeling, any kind of feeling, we develop different kinds of thirst. We have a thirst to continue that, or a thirst to be free of that unpleasant feeling, or just to keep existing. That leaves imprint in our mind. This is this thirst, the fellow that's drinking, is one of the kinds of delusions or klesha, right? When that intensifies, especially at the time of death, that particular kind of extreme thirst that's called here, like the monkey grasping, is what ripens the karmic imprints that were put on our mind in the third link, let's say, that may have existed till this time, right? So at the time of death, what is going to determine what karmic seeds on our consciousness are ripening so that they will throw us into the next existence is our state of mind. You know, there might be a grasping, like out of attachment, that ripens certain karmic seeds in our consciousness. There might be a grasping that's motivated by sort of fear or anger that ripens other kinds of seeds on our mind. And they give rise to the next link. What is that? What does that look like? Is that again Kung Fu or Qigong? That looks more like Qigong than the last one. What do you think? Is there anything particular about that? Is that a man or a woman? What is it? Woman, right? Is she running or what is she doing? Can you know, Cece? What is it? Well, yeah, it's not so obvious. I mean, she's supposed to be pregnant, right? So when a woman is pregnant, has she given birth? So she hasn't, you know, there hasn't been birth yet, but she's about to give birth, right? Although maybe in some representations the belly is a little more pronounced, so you know that she's pregnant. This one is called becoming or existence. The same word that this wheel is called bhava. This is called the bhava chakra, the wheel of becoming or the wheel of existence. You know, the whole representation, the wheel. Sometimes they call it the wheel of life, but this. So she has, maybe she has life in her belly, or in her womb, rather. So this represents the karmic seed that had been deposited in our consciousness due to the potter making some karma, our potter mind, that has been ripened from craving and grasping, and now is ready to give, throw us into the next existence, what is called throwing karma or projecting karma. The karmic seeds that on our mind stream can ripen in different ways. They can ripen in experiences during life as a cool breeze coming when you're hot because of some virtuous karma you created in the past, or a hot breeze coming when you're hot, making you more uncomfortable, kind of the karmic results of something you did unpleasant to others in the past. It can be you having a short life or a long life, your medicine being effective or not effective, you hearing harsh words or pleasant words. Many, many ways the karma can ripen on your experience, but the most, in a sense, the most essential one is what's called the maturation effect, maturation result of karma. One karmic seed can have many different results, but the main thing is it can throw you into another life. It can mature or ripen as a rebirth as a human or an animal or a hungry ghost or a hell being or a god. So the lady, the pregnant lady, represents this karmic seed ready to throw you into the next life. It's called, one way translated, is becoming or existence. And then what's the next one? Is that Milarepa meditating in his cave? Not so clear. What is it? Was supposed to be a lady who, that pregnant lady, same lady before, does she look the same? Now she's giving birth. I don't know if you're supposed to see the baby just between her legs there. I don't know. Is that supposed to be a baby head coming out? Anyway, this is called birth, not surprisingly. So as a result of becoming, being pregnant, having life within the womb, the result of that is birth. So the karma that we left on our mind stream, on the third length on it, has been ripened from craving and grasping. It is, and that the link called becoming, the pregnant lady, is that also, so craving and grasping are delusions. They are afflictions, klesha. What is becoming? Is that also an affliction? Who knows? No. So what is that? Svikamya. It's a result. It's actually karma also. There are two links in the wheel of life which are karma. One is what? The second link. Karmic formation of karma. And the other karma is the pregnant lady becoming. Where is that? Over here. Why is that karma? Because it's the same karmic seed that was deposited, that has remained in the consciousness maybe for many lifetimes. And finally, because of in one lifetime at the time of death, craving and grasping have caused it to be ready to give birth. The pregnant lady here, the becoming, means that that karmic seed now, the karma, is ready to bring its results. So that the third link and, what is this, the tenth link, are both karma. both instances of karma. There are three klesha among the 12 links, three delusions. What are those? Well, what's the first link? Ignorance. That's a disturbing emotion. That's klesha. Do you know the word klesha? Maybe, do you know that word? The lady in the back that... Do you know? You don't know. So this Indian word that... So I shouldn't use that. I should just say delusion or, you know, afflicted state of mind. Like, say, for instance, ignorance is an afflicted state of mind. But also, there are two more. Craving and grasping. Craving is like strong attachment. Grasping is like extreme attachment when you're actually acting it out, you know? So of the 12 links, there are three deluded states of mind, three kleshas. The first link, ignorance, and then the links of craving and grasping. And there are two karmas. The second link, the formation of karma, and then the link of becoming. And then there, the seven are all the leftover seven are, because there's 12 altogether, right? So two karmas, three klesha make five, so there's seven left over. The other seven are results. And what's the last one? What's the 12th link up there? Looks like someone carrying a big bag of durian on their back, right? Now, what is it carrying? Can you tell? Because you can kind of see the leg and the head and the shroud on the person's back. In Tibet, has anyone ever experienced the sky burial in Tibet? Anyone been to Tibet? A couple people? Have you heard of sky burial? Maybe you've seen a documentary when a person dies in the, especially in the past, maybe now with the Chinese, it's not so prevalent, but the body would be taken up to a mountain where people who kind of, this is their profession, they would cut up the body, the corpse, with long, like, machetes, and they would place it in this place in the rocks, which has been used for this. And vultures know this. They would be circling around, and they would come down and eat the flesh from the bones of the person. This is called sky burial. Earth burial means what we call burying someone under the earth. Water burial, what is that, do you know? When the corpse would be put in a river or body of water to decompose. That's a very in India, when people didn't have the funds to have their family member cremated, in the Vedic traditions, in Hindu traditions, they would just place the body in a body of water, like the Ganges. So although we have all these poetic sayings about the pure water of the Ganges, in recent centuries has been quite polluted because of bacteria from the many decaying corpses. Also, alligators come to eat the corpses in the water. So that's called water burial. And then burial by fire means cremation. So in places like Tibet, in isolated places where wood is a premium, they didn't cremate a person. Sometimes the lamas or monks or a wealthy lay person would, their body would be cremated when they passed away if the family had resources to buy wood. Usually in certain places in Tibet in the past, it was rare. It was not so easy to dig in the rocky places. So earth burial, I don't even know before Christianity entered Tibet if there were earth burials very often. Water burial might have happened, but generally the sky burial that didn't cost anything other than some offering you made to the people who cut up the body. At the end, the skull of the dead person is cut open. The top, which is like a cup, is called in India. You know what's it called at the top? Kapala. You've probably heard in different things that offering, the deities holding the skull cup, the top of the head. And the brain would be of the person would be mixed up with some grains, barley and other, maybe some sweet things. They'd be put in the cup, and that would be offered to the vultures after they'd consumed the flesh. And that was a signal, that was kind of like dessert. So then they flew off. They knew they could fly off. Then the bones would be accumulated and whatever. So this last link represents death. So that doesn't mean that's the end of a person's existence. Our mental consciousness, our subtle consciousness will continue on, but that's the end of any one life, right? You're born, you have happiness and suffering, you die. That's usually what the worldly people say. There's some funny expressions, you know. You're born, you have a lot of, I don't know, they say some bad words, you know. Things happen, and then you die. So this is called, these are called the 12 links. And that's what, in the next discourse we'll have next week, what we're calling the 12 links 102 or whatever, you know, advanced 12 links. We'll talk more in detail about those, but a little bit more about this drawing. So you know, outside Yama, the Lord of Death, represents impermanence. So all of the 12 links that we experience again and again, you know, creating karma, leaving imprints on our mind stream, many, many imprints that we create this lifetime, to take rebirth in the future, some distant future time, you know, taking, you know, having name and form, taking a rebirth, experiencing the creation of our sense faculties, having contact with objects, as a result of contact with objects, having feeling. Feelings give rise to craving and grasping. So pleasant feelings generally give rise to attachment. Unpleasant feelings give rise to angered repulsion. Neutral feelings give rise to just like an ignorant acceptance. So all of these are explaining in more detail the Buddha's presentation of how we cycle, how we circle in cyclic existence. In samsara. Remember that word, that name, samsara? I mentioned in one other class that in the monastery, Kopan, when I first came in 1974, before I was a monk, I noticed that the Sangha, the Western monks and nuns, have their own bathroom, one for the men, one for the women. The men's bathroom was labeled Sam, and the women's one is Sarah. Or Sara, you know, Samsara. So I thought it was very clever, you know. Sam and Sara. Is it still there? Did they? At Koban? No, I think it's probably changed now. But I think that was quite clever. Samsara. So samsara is an Indian word that means cyclic existence. Taking rebirth without control again and again, you know, having a life most of the time in unpleasant states. So what are the states that we can take rebirth in cyclic existence, in samsara? Well, that's represented by the next inner wheel from the outer rim. Those are the 12 links. Then the next section has how many sections are there? Six sections? So at the very bottom, the bottom section down here, who's that in the center, that big red character? Satan. Okay. No, that's this guy. That's Yama. That's where he's the Lord of Death. He's sort of not only does he come like the Grim Reaper, you know, to make sure you leave when you die. You don't argue with him. You can't argue with the Lord of Death. When the Lord of Death comes, you can't ask for extra time, right? You know, oh, just give me a couple more minutes. So the Lord of Death is also sort of presiding in the hell realm. So we can translate that in Sanskrit they call the Naraks. The Narak, there are various different kinds of hell experiences. Some are extremely related with the tactile sensation of heat, hot, the hot hells. Many, many different levels, maybe nine or something. There's also cold hells. You can imagine someone freezing to death in the Arctic. That must be excruciatingly painful. So there are cold hells. And then there are other kinds of hells that are neither hot, not dominated by hot nor cold, but other kinds of experiences. So this is of the various sufferings in cyclic existence, generally the lowest of the hell realms, the most extreme suffering of the hell realms is generally the most painful physical feeling. Is it the most painful mental feeling in the six realms of samsara? What do you think? What? It's the most painful mental feeling too? Maybe some people. Generally they say the gods of the desire realm that have pleasure for eons, you know. They have physical forms, not the formless realm, just below that like the gods that in Indian mythology had some interaction with humans because of their clairvoyance and so forth. Incredible pleasures all their life. Almost whatever you think of would arise, you know, because of their karma. Some people here are almost like that. You know, whatever you think of, you need. Oh, there it is. You know, almost like the God realm. When that karma begins to fade at the time of death of the desire realm gods, there is incredible mental anguish for some of them that it had, like the king of the gods or the royal family of the gods. For them, that mental anguish is said to be even greater than the mental anguish of the hell realms. Can you imagine that? That usually we think of the desire realm gods as everything good. But when you fall from that, like for instance, politicians who have great power, you know, very proud, and then when they fall from that power, which is inevitable, incredible depression. I remember the president that was American president, Nixon, supposedly when he was kind of forced to resign, he was going to be impeached, he was forced to resign, he was almost going crazy. And he even had psychosomatic, I think he had something in his leg called phlebitis. What is that? Anyone doctor here? Some kind of blood thing, I think from the worry, you know, and the anguish. So anyway, the lower one here represents the hell realms that we have all been charter members of since beginning this time. That's our general location in cyclic existence. You might think that you're not going to hell, you never did anything bad, but we've created, even in this lifetime, we may have created actions to be born in hell. Probably many, but in previous lifetimes, when we were less fortunate, maybe when we were animals, when we were ghosts, or even when we were hell and hell beings before, we've created the karma to be born in hell. And there's many seeds, like the potter, karmic seeds that we've created in past lives that are still in our consciousness to take rebirth there. So looking at it, on the left of the hell realm, as you're looking at it, what's that? It looks like some Salvador Dali painting, doesn't it? Do you know what that is supposed to represent? What in English we sometimes translate as the hungry ghost, in Indian language, in Sanskrit, is called the pretas. The pretas are a realm that have very excruciating physical and mental suffering also. Their main suffering is one of not finding what they want, which is, for instance, water or food. Some of them have extended bellies. It's not so, one or two. The one on the left of the drawing there looks like the belly is a little extended. What's coming out of their mouth? Flames. So there's some pretas, some hungry ghosts, whose, because of karma, their throats are constricted, and even they can't even get a drop of water for eons. They might have lifespans. Let's say the lifespans in hell vary according to the different levels. It might be, maybe the shortest hell might be 50,000 years, 20,000 years. Can you imagine? The longest one might be eons. The hungry ghosts, the pretas, might live for, 100,000 years or something like that, always in want, never finding what they desire, food and drink. Incredible anguish. They are not, in some of the three lower realms, and we haven't talked yet about the animal realm, of the three lower realms, hell, animals, and preta, in one sense the pretas could be put near the top in terms of their bondage, because they can understand, they have sharp minds, they can be actually taught the Dharma. Some pretas maybe even have realization of impermanence and so forth. But generally, their suffering, they may or may not cause us harm. When we talk about spirits, usually in Chinese culture, you talk about ghosts coming back or your family members and so forth, different spirits. Do you talk about spirits besides family members? So some of those spirits might be pretas, but probably most of them are in some other realms, maybe in the Naga realm, which realm are the Nagas in? Do you know? In the animal realm, other kinds of spirits. So these three in the bottom are called the three lower realms, or the bad migrations, unfortunate migrations. The other unfortunate migration is over here, as you're looking at it on the right. And what are those? Animals. There are birds and serpents and fish and deers and yaks and leopards and horses, snow lion up in the right-hand corner. So the animal realm, although the animal realm doesn't seem to have so much suffering, there's constant bondage. Looking for most animals that live in the wild have some predator who wants to eat them, right? Consume them. Or as an animal, we numberless times have hunted other animals or bugs or snakes as our food. So we've created, being born in the animal realm, generally ignorant, although you might think your your poodle or your New Zealand sheepdog is very intelligent, maybe more intelligent than your neighbor. My dog is much better than that person. Generally animals, even you tell your French poodle, a poodle's supposed to be one of the smartest dogs, right? Not the French poodle, not the small one. Or maybe you tell your dog or your New Zealand sheepdog, supposed to be very smart, and you say, practice the Dharma. recite Om Mani Padme Hum, they just go, wag their tail, right? Maybe you can teach them something they don't necessarily understand. There may be some that have karmic instinct for virtue. Of course, some animals feel compassion for other animals. We see, you know. One animal of a different species of animal might actually suckle another baby of another species, you know. You see. But in general, animals, out of ignorance, create negative karma. Out of what seems like inescapable necessity. Can if you bring a big pile of delicious leaves that other animals might find very pleasant to eat, or hay, and you put it before a carnivorous animal like a lion, what's that lion going to do? It's going to look at you like, yeah? So what? You know? It's not going to be interested in that at all. So lion, because of the karma it's created in the past, other carnivorous animals, has no choice but to kill. And you might think, oh, that mitigates. That means the lion not creating negative karma. It doesn't want to kill, you might say. But, well, it does want to kill because it needs to have the flesh. But why does it find itself in that situation? Because of karma it created in the past. It's still creating negative karma through that killing, you know, in eating and so forth. So the animals, due to their ignorance, due to their creation of negative karma, are in some ways more suffering than the pretas, you know, in terms of their ability to make, you know, to practice dharma and so forth. So above that are three upper realms. So one of them, as you look at the picture, the one on the left is what? That sixth of the picture? That's the human realm, right? So what's happening there? There are people living in a house, a lady giving birth, there's someone dying, so some of the links are there. There's a monk, there's a fellow on a horse who is, I'm not sure what he's doing. There's a person, a farmer at the top with his oxen. So all the worldly concerns. And then there at the top of that segment, there's a monastery with lama giving teachings and the monks debating. So there's different kinds of things you can do. You can have, you know, ordinary worldly life, commerce or so forth, or you can have a monastic kind of life. That's the human realm. Generally, this half above the cross line here are called the upper realms. Above that, in the top, is what's called the Deva realm, or the God realm. And there's a palace there, there's a goddess that's playing a musical instrument, and other people around. This is the one we talked about before, the desire realm gods that different cultures have immortalized in their own mythologies. You know, the Greek culture had gods, the Roman culture had gods. The Native American Indians had different kinds of spirits and gods and so forth. So the God realm is said to be, the Deva realm is said to be the pinnacle of the pleasure of our desire realm. Like we were saying before, almost anything you wish when you're born in a high status there comes true. You know, like, I'd like to have a chocolate milkshake. It just almost appears, you know. To the right, as you're looking at the picture, is a realm slightly below that, called the Asura realm, or the they're not quite gods. They're kind of like the Hollywood B-list. Do you know what that means? What is the Hollywood B-list? Does that mean something to you? Yeah, what does that mean? Or maybe in Singapore also. It means not quite this movie star level, but below that and have incredible jealousy to the A-list, right? So these kinds of gods are called asuras. Sura is another name for the devas. The letter A at the beginning, asura, means they're not suras. So it means they are they don't have that status. They're kind of B-list, right? So they have incredible jealousy for the deva realm. And as a result of that jealousy, they're in constant conflict. So this little segment between the deva realm and the asura realm, right here, this little, see these people fighting? That's sort of representing the conflict between the asuras and the devas. And there's one fellow in the asura realm, you see there's a tree? So the tree represents a tree that ripens in the deva realm, but is actually, the roots are in the asura realm. So the asuras are really annoyed about this. It's like, maybe like, how would you say, what kind of example would we say? Like servants of the Hollywood elite or the Singapore, Crazy Rich Singaporeans. Did you see that movie, Crazy Rich Asians? I saw it on the airplane coming over. Did you see? Oh, we should see that one. I think it must be on DVD by now. You can rent it. So the very, very rich, was it Michelle Yao, or you know, she plays this matriarch. So let's say the servants, they do all the work. Maybe they cook the food, but they can't eat it. They have to give it, you know. So like there's some jealousy. So in the asura realm, there's some kind of jealousy like that. It's almost like the fruits that are ripening in the deva realm are actually planted in the asura realm. So that fellow in that segment next to the tree, what does he have in his hand? Has an axe, right? He's trying to chop down the tree. And in up there in the clouds is the war between the devas and the asuras. Generally, who wins? Who? The Suras? The Devas generally win. It's said that in times in conflict in the world, when everything is reversed, when bad people are in power, sometimes that indicates that the Asuras are winning in the God realm. Maybe like now, you know. I shouldn't make political statements, but like Trump. You know, these kind of corrupt people in power. I hope I'm not offending anyone, as if there's someone who's... I had to be careful in America sometimes, especially in the south of the United States, because there are a lot of supporters of Trump, and if I would say something critical, they'd get quite unhappy. I hope no one has become unhappy here. So these are called the six realms. And these are the realms, how is that related to the 12 links? Because when we have left a karmic imprint in our mind stream that's ripened by craving, grasping, eventually to that seed ready to give its rebirth in becoming, when we take rebirth in one of these six realms. Many, many different, from Buddhist perspective, many, many different universes. It's said that in our world system, there are approximately a billion worlds where human beings and animals and so forth live. I sometimes think, just because I studied a little science in college, you know how many stars there are in our galaxy? I bet Joy knows. Do you know how many stars there are? Oh, do you know? You studied with Kip Thorne, right? Do you know how many stars, approximately, in our galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy? So it might be, when the latest estimates, because they're never sure, the black matter and everything, they say maybe in the order of 10 billion or something like that. So when they talk about the billion world systems, I often think that may represent world systems around a billion of these 10 billion or so stars, maybe one out of 10 or one out of 100 of the stars. Or maybe you know, certain number of the stars have planetary systems around them with humans and so forth. So Buddhism believes that such things exist. And just out of curiosity, there's something almost the same number of galaxies in our universe from what we can see with the telescopes. There's order of maybe 10 to 100 billion galaxies that they can see outside in our so-called universe. Buddhism believes that there are even other universes with systems that are coming into existence and going out into existence and so forth. So these are in all of these systems, there are something similar. There's a human-like experience, there's a hell-like experience, animal-like experience, ghost-like experience, god-like experience, anti-god. Then within that, the next rim in, you see this? One side is white, one side is black, right? So what does this represent, you know? What, Joy? Karma? Good guess, white and black karma. Anyone? No? So this represents the so-called intermediate state. Have you heard of the intermediate, the bardo? So when we die, our mind, our subtle mind, leaves this gross body. Before we die, the gross mind kind of absorbs like it does at the time of sleep, right? There's no sense of personality. A subtle essence of our consciousness, the subtlemost mind, when we actually die, leaves the body and enters into an intermediate state before taking rebirth. Tibetans say bardo. Bar means between. Bardo means the in-between place. If we're going to take rebirth in the upper realms due to virtuous karma, white karma, it's as though that's represented by the white segment there. The people are going upward, right? See, they're flowing upward. They're going to the upper realms. The black side means people that were going into the bardo because of negative karma, black karma, that are going down. And they have various, you see the ones that are going down, one has the shape of a bull, one looks like they're being, fire is coming out of their mouth, maybe like pretas and hell beings and so forth. So these are represent beings that are going to take rebirth in the lower realms, in the bardo state, in the intermediate state, because in the intermediate state you have a physical form that's similar to the body that you're going to take rebirth as. And the other side, that looks like there's a representation of human, asura, and deva, right? You see, going up. So that represents the intermediate state. And then the very center hub, what is there? What is it? You have to say more loud. Ignorance. Who can expand? So there's three animals, right? One, it looks like, it's not quite clear what it is at the bottom. It's supposed to be a pig that generally represents the mental poison of ignorance. If you were to subsume all of our afflicted states of mind into three, we call it the three poisonous minds, ignorance, attachment, and hatred. All of our, unruly states of mind can be somehow put in one of those categories. So out of the mouth of the pig is coming it's supposed to be a chicken, which represents attachment. And the snake represents what? Hatred, right? So the fact that it's coming out of the mouth of the pig represents the fact that attachment and hatred actually find their origin in a very primal kind of ignorance that grasps at our self-identity, you know, that believes there's a real findable self. Okay? So that's the general with yama going through the various links. At the top, on the upper right-hand side, who is that? That's a person, right? Who is that? Do you know? That's the Buddha. What's he doing? Can the Buddha take out the pain from our lives? Can the Buddha take us out of samsara and put us into nirvana or whatever? No, you know. No, come on, George, don't be silly. You're shaking your head. come on, no, of course not. The famous verse in the Dharmapada, the Buddhas do not take out pain in the same way that you can take out, extricate a thorn from your foot, right? The Buddhas do not wash away sins like the Hindus believe by taking a bath in the Ganges, a holy river that you can wash away your sins. The Buddhas do not transmit their, you know, realizations by hand. You might think if you go to the Lama, you know, the Lama touches your head and you feel some electricity and now suddenly you have some quality you didn't have before, you know, like you want to see the Dalai Lama because he will transmit to you, give you something that you didn't have before. I said the Buddhas don't do any of those. The Buddhas show the way. So that's what's, so what's the Buddha pointing to here? Is he pointing to space? What is he pointing to? KK, where is he? Come on. Leave that text. What's he pointing? Pardon? He's pointing at the full moon, right? What does that represent? White light? Cheese? Buddha likes cheese? Mozzarella? I had some mozzarella the other night. It was a big glob in this restaurant. It looked like that full moon, but that's not it. Pardon? Karma? Oh, Dharma. Maybe Dharma, yeah. It's supposed to represent cessation. Cessation, which is when we talk about the Four Noble Truths, right? You know what the Four Noble Truths are? Truth of what? Suffering, the truth of the origin of suffering, what the causes are, the truth of cessation of suffering, and then the truth of the path that leads to cessation. So this, in a sense, you could say it represents Dharma. That was a good, but particularly it represents the truth of cessation. So when we take refuge in the Dharma, if those of you who have studied a little bit about Buddhism, what is the actual Dharma refuge? The Prajnaparamita Sutra, texts on bodhicitta, what's the refuge? The Vinaya teachings about renunciation? No. Actual refuge is true cessation, like the moon here. That's the actual Dharma refuge. The ultimate refuge, because when you've ceased ignorance, attachment, hatred, you know, the self-grasping from your mind, when you have a cessation of that so that you will never return again, that's the ultimate perfection. That's the ultimate refuge from suffering, because you won't experience suffering again. Along with true cessation, the true path that leads to cessation is also called Dharma refuge, you know, the definitive Dharma refuge. Why is that? Because when you're, the true path that leads to cessation is not generally when people talk in Theravada countries or Chinese Mahayana countries, they think it means the Eightfold Noble Path. You know, the truth of the path means the Eightfold. That's not the ultimate meaning. The true path means when you have a direct realization of emptiness, selflessness, in that meditative equipoise, the delusions are not present. You have a direct realization, not something with a mental image, what emptiness might be like, but actually experience of that. In that meditative equipoise, some delusions are ceasing, but that's not the main thing. In that meditative equipoise, no delusion is present in your mind stream at that point. They're all either ceased or they're dormant. So that's also called the Dharma refuge. True path and true cessations are the Dharma refuge. So here, the Buddha's pointing to, you could say from what you said back there, the lady said, you could say Dharma refuge, but in particular it's referring to the ultimate Dharma refuge, true cessation. So then at the bottom, there's some little verse here. What does it say? It looks like written by someone who didn't know Tibetan. Sampajashing Chewarja, Jungwarja, Sangye Tenla Jukpaja. Oh, I see. This makes sense. Generally, there's different verses that have come. One verse that sometimes comes, I've seen at the Dalai Lama's temple. I remember the first time I visited in India, where the Dalai Lama resides, a large Tibetan community in the mountains, northwest India, called Dharamshala, and then above that, where the Tibetans live, Makhlaud Ganj. There was a little verse on the... It was written in English, but a translation from a famous verse that we say in condensation of the Buddhist teachings. Perform no negative action. Do all that is virtuous. Completely tame your mind. This is the teaching of the Buddha. So is that Roger back there? As Roger was saying yesterday, first step is don't harm others. Even if you can't help them yet, at least restrain yourself. Start to overcome your anger and attachment, your clinginess, your problematic edges that cause problems for others. Once you've begun to tame your mind so you're not a problem for others, then you can start to help them. If you start from the very beginning I want to help all beings, I'm going to Africa to alleviate malaria or whatever, but your mind is not tamed, you're not going to be very successful in helping them. So first, tame your mind. Don't create negative actions. Then learn how to help, to develop good hearts, compassion and love. Then completely tame the mind refers to the culmination of that, developing the insight into emptiness, to ultimate wisdom that sees how we actually exist. Right now, our fundamental problem is a kind of primal ignorance that inhabits our consciousness that believes I. If someone says, you're a thief, or you're dumb, we're indignant. We don't necessarily, although sometimes we identify with our body, if we're looking, it looks not so bad, or if I look today, I hadn't shaved, I don't look so good, or you gain some pounds, you lose some pounds, you have different, you might identify with your body at various times. Either the appearance or the clumsiness or I'm really a great athlete or, I can run or whatever. Sometimes you identify with your mind. If someone says, you are so smart. You might kind of think of yourself as being your mind. There are many kinds. Or someone says you're dumb, or you criticize yourself. But when you, all of those are transient and not fundamental perceptions of our self-identity. If you check very deeply in meditation, beyond those, when those disappear, there's still a sense of I existing, appearing to our mental consciousness that seems to be, in a sense, independent of the body and mind. Maybe that appearance is what in many religions people called either the soul, or in Indian religions they call the Atma. Have you heard the Atma? Remember Gandhi's name? What was his epithet? Mahatma, right? Mahatma, the great soul or the great being. Atma is a word the Indians believe there's some kind of eternal soul. And the Buddha said, it appears to be there. And I think, I'm not sure, there was one famous Christian theologian, maybe Thomas Aquinas, I can't remember, who said, you didn't have, you know, because a big thing in Christian theology was, could you prove the existence of the soul? Because that was a big, is still one of the dominant, what do you say, theological points of Christianity. The soul is going to either go to heaven or hell, or the what's the other place called? Purgatory. Almost sounds like the Bardo, doesn't it, or something. One Christian philosopher, theologian said, there was, you know, you didn't have to prove the existence of the soul. It was apparent, so clear, that it was, you know, when you looked at yourself, that there was something there, seemed to be independent of the body and mind. I think that was almost a recognition of the object of negation, you know. But believing it, by the object of negation, if you don't know what I'm talking about, that means, from a Buddhist perspective, something appears like a soul to our mind. And I don't mean to put it just here. I mean, just sense that there is some I exist independent of the body and mind, and in a real findable way, almost as though you could point to it, sort of almost seemingly irrefutable. The Buddha said that is an illusion. In the same way that we, if we see a mirage in the distance, have you all know what a mirage is? If you see a mirage, if it's actually a mirage and someone is with you, or you're intelligent about the driving on the highway, sometimes you see a mirage, sometimes in the desert you see a mirage, but you know it's actually devoid of water there, right? There's no water there, although it appears to be water. If I said it's empty of water, would that make sense? Was there ever water there in that mirage? There was never water there, but it appears to be, to an untrained mind, to be water in the distance. So like that, the self appears to our consciousness when you let go of, when you delve deeply in meditation, and the other, you know, thoughts of your mind are calmed down, you can see this sense of the self, and you can understand that our mind believes that. You can watch how the mind reacts to that. Like watching someone in the desert, how they're reacting to the mirage. Some people are running toward the mirage thinking there's water. Other people are going, yeah, another mirage. You know, someone who's more wise to the way, you know, that the mirage is empty of water. So the Buddha taught that this self does appear, but it is empty of existing the way that it appears. It's that realization that can help us to escape from the wheel of existence, to achieve a state of liberation or nirvana. And eventually, with that kind of realization, along with empathy for others, bodhicitta, great compassion for others, can lead us to enlightenment. So this was the 12 Links 101. next time we're going to go into some of the little more nitty-gritty of the 12 links, because the meditation on these 12, the outer rim, the Buddha taught was a deeper way to understand how we find ourselves in cyclic existence and how we can extricate ourselves from cyclic existence. In more detail and a little more difficult to understand than just the general presentation of the Four Noble Truths. Four Noble Truths, on one hand, explain our situation, there's suffering, what the cause of it is, the fact that it can be ceased, and what the path is. But here, this is talking about it in a more detailed way. It's said that between the two main Hinayana disciples, sort of the Buddha, what we call the hearers, the Shravakas. Have you heard that name before? The Shravakas were the main people that you disciples of the Buddha at the time of the Buddha, Shariputra and Mahamudgalyana and, these ones. And then there were another set of Hinayana disciples called the solitary realizers or Pratitya Buddhas that didn't like to be around when teaching Buddhas came. Between those two disciples, the hearers mainly meditated on the Four Noble Truths to escape, to attain nirvana. The Pratika Buddhas would remain longer and have deeper insight. They would meditate mainly on the 12 links of dependent origination, what we're talking about here. So it's said to be give a greater depth of understanding of what our plight is in cyclic existence. So it's said to be a very, very powerful object of meditation to enhance our understanding of the Four Noble Truths and to help to develop renunciation and so forth. And also we talk about meditation on the forward 12 links, going from ignorance to karmic formation to consciousness. We talk about the reverse order, starting from death. If you want to cease death, you have to cease birth. How do you cease birth? You have to cease becoming. You have to cease craving and grasping and so forth. There's called the forward 12 links of the positive side and the negative side, and the reverse ones, the positive and negative side. We'll talk about in 12 links 102, next class. Also, when one meditates on the 12 links, eventually you meditate on the emptiness of the 12 links also. So we have a minute or two, a couple of minutes. Anyone have any question? Yes. Cat and a tiger?
So right at the very bottom, 6 o'clock, there's a...
Oh, they're here?
Yeah.
No, that's the Yama's... He's got some shame, so he wears a tiger skin lower garment. That's his lower garment hanging down. You know, like the monks, this robe, right, there's a lower garment called the shamdab. So that's his shamdab to hide his sexual parts. So he has some shame also. So that I guess it's the head of the tiger, and that you see the tiger stripes and the paw. So that's supposed to be his lower garment. Okay. Good. Yeah.
When we talk about the inner circle and the six upper realms and the three upper realms and the three lower realms,
right.
And you said that we take rebirth in these six realms.
Yes.
Should I interpret that as meaning that we take rebirth in one at any one time when we go around one cycle, or can I alternatively interpret that as sometimes our state of mind or state of existence, even though we are in the physical realm can exhibit certain characteristics of these realms, each of these realms that you've described.
So there's popular, you know, some people who popularize Buddhism, and they do mention, Buddha's mentioned sometimes, you can have, as a human, you can have experiences like an animal existence for a while. We know today there are people that are slaves, human trafficking, that are others act upon them that the same way that we treat animals, beating and enslaving. I'm not sure there's cannibalism. Maybe there's cannibalism, like the animals eating us. There are human experience like the hungry ghosts, walking the streets, looking for love, looking for success, never finding it, depressed all the time, almost like preta existence. There's some humans, like that we said, the Hollywood A-list, like the devas, the Hollywood B-list, like the asuras. And then there's some experiences like hell. As a human, you know, during World War II when the Nazis had the camps, Dachau and so forth, people incinerated while they're alive, you know, coming in thinking they're taking a shower and burned up, gassed or incinerated, the body's incinerated, almost like a hell existence. So sometimes said like that, but generally there are mirrors of those six realms as a human and even as an animal and, you know, all of them. But that doesn't negate the fact that these six realms do exist and that we can be reborn in them. The fact that we have some similitude of them, something similar to them as a human, if one delves into that, it almost leads you to think there must be something beyond this that is like that. Once in England, many years ago, there was a documentary on TV about Buddhism, and the head of the British Buddhist Society, Sir Christmas Humphreys, I don't know if anyone ever read, it was a long time ago. Did you remember that name? He wrote some books about Buddhism. He was head of the London British Buddhist Society, I think. Barrister, very, you know, because he was head of the London Buddhist Society. Supposedly he was being interviewed because he was some kind of authority. He said, oh no, there's nothing, there's no rebirths after this. You know, Buddhists don't believe that. It was, you know, completely his own opinion. Then there was a little interview with the Dalai Lama. It wasn't a panel. It was just taken some other time. And they asked the Dalai Lama, do these exist? And he said, yes. These states of rebirth definitely happen. The fact that we don't perceive them now doesn't mean that they don't exist. There are many things that we don't perceive now that do exist. Say, for instance, do you perceive the dark side of the moon? No, you always see the same side of the moon. You know what I'm talking about, right? Its rotation is such that you always see the same side. But we know now that the dark side of the moon exists. I mean, we believe. So many things that we don't, just because we don't perceive something like past and future lives, doesn't mean they don't exist. Like, say, for instance, being in a dark room. Say, if it's nighttime, no stars, no moon, all the lights are off in here, and we're in here in the room. It's just you and I, we're talking. And I say, oh, what's your name? Deborah. I say, Deborah, is there anyone else in the room? You kind of look around and say, no. And then someone turns on the light, and you see everyone here. You know? So the fact that you don't see can be for different reasons. It can be that you have the ability to see, but there's nothing there, like there's no elephant or tiger right here. Or it can be a case of not having the ability to see, like being in the dark room. So generally we say that there's obscuration in our mind now that prevents us from remembering, recalling past lives. there are beings at the time of the Buddha that developed clairvoyance to recall their past lives. There's an actual strategy to do that. Like you can begin, like from today, remembering what happened 5 minutes ago. You know, I was still sitting here, and then 10 minutes before that, I was making notes, and then before that, I walked into the room. Before that, I was down at the car. Before that, or I was at the MRT or whatever. You go back through the events of the day. Then I had breakfast. And before that, I was brushing my teeth. Before that, I woke up. Before that, you can make the jump to the last thought last night before you went to bed. When I was falling asleep, I was. Then you go back through the events of yesterday, sort of like looking at a newsreel all during your life, all the way back to the time of birth. You do that again and again. If you have single-pointed concentration, what's called calm abiding, shamatha, it's possible through that kind of exercise, training your mind, in the same way that you can go from the first thought this morning to the last thought last night, you can go from the first perception of this life in the womb to the last perception of last life. You can make that jump also through that dark, what is now obscured to us. So with that, it's a couple of minutes after 12. I know some people have to get off to appointments. Thank you for coming. Let's make a short dedication. Dedication means to try to steer the virtuous karma that we've created this morning. Make a strong aspiration or wish that it ripen in such a way that it will continuously enhance our spiritual development in such a way that we benefit others. If we're wealthy, may we use that wealth to, you know, benefit other people that are suffering, to alleviate suffering, to spread the Dharma. If we're famous and attractive, may we use that charisma to benefit others. In whatever way that the virtuous karma I've created this morning in listening and with attentive minds to these teachings, whatever way it ripens, may it bring about my spiritual development for the benefit of all sentient beings, all living beings. Thank you very much. Now, I'm not absolutely certain, but Sui Kim has walked out. I think he has offered these to us. Is that right? So I think that's incredibly generous. I think this sold in the store? No? Or we have... Okay, so this is for you to keep... Bring next time if you can, and we'll continue. And see if you can review. You've got a pictorial thing. See if you can review all the parts and remember. Grade yourself. Pass, fail. Thank you very much. Based on